typically we follow that schedule. But this year we decided to change things up a little bit. It fit a little bit better with where Steve was going to be at in his messages. He's going to be doing all of Advent starting next week. And he's actually going to be breaking the last, normally you do the last Advent right before Christmas, but he's actually going to combine them together on Christmas Day this year, so it'd be kind of a treat. It also fit a bit where I was at, so he asked me if we could move him back, and I was totally fine with that. So even though we are rounding the corner, and if you guys are like me, Christmas decorations are already out. It's like the first minute after you're finished with Thanksgiving, you turn on the Christmas music and start rounding the corner. But it's a great time of year as we turn that way. But today we're going to be wrapping up the book of Mark. We've been in this all year. We've been focusing on our theme, which is Christ-centered living, and looking at Christ, how he is our example, and how we can better imitate him and center our lives, both individually in our personal lives and also as a body together with him. I have to say, that it's wonderful just to sing that song together. I stopped singing for a bit there and just listened, and just to hear everyone in here singing, "I love you, Lord," just such a wonderful thing. I believe that's what heaven is going to be like as we unite our voices around and sing praises to him. Thank you for leading us in that today. They did great for a last minute, I think. So, but today as we look and we close out Mark, and there's a lot of different things that we were looking at and trying to figure out, how do we summarize everything? As you know, here at Oak Grove, we split up the teaching and we kind of all come at it from a different perspective. But one way or another, we've made it through the book. And there's a lot of different things that we could focus on. If you were to open up your bulletins, this week we did something a little different instead of study questions. They're kind of like study questions, but this is where I started in my prep this week, as I just decided, let me go through the book and see if I can find some examples of how Christ is our example, how we can imitate him. And the funny thing is I wrote down this list, and there were 16 of them. And I was like, oh, there's 16 chapters. It's 2016. This was our theme. It wasn't intentional. It just happened that way. But I got all nerdy on that one. But I thought it was kind of fun. Those, we're not going to go through every one of them today. That's for you to take home and for you to look at. Hopefully, that is not the exhaustive list, obviously, of things that we can see Christ as our example. But hopefully you can add to that. And I would even say the passages that are next to them aren't like the full extensive list of supporting passages for each of those. They're just kind of example texts. But truly, Christ came to be not just our sacrifice on the cross and the one that bridged this gap and paid for our sin, but he was our example in his life as well. So I tried to think of what is something that, which one do I pick and which one do I want to focus on as we close out the book? And there's something that I kept coming back to that felt to me to be an undercurrent under all of them and foundational to all the things that Christ did while he lived and walked this earth. And that really has to do with his submission to the Father and how in everything he was submitted to the Father and how he made a very distinct point of that. And I believe that is... that's probably one of, if not the most important thing that Christ was trying to demonstrate through his life to us. Of course, his purpose for coming was to be the Passover lamb for the sin of the world, but in his life, he demonstrated something and he showed us an example, and I do think that's the most important part of it. So we're going to look at that today, how Christ was our example, and then we're going to look at the other side of it, and that is our part, and that is faith. And how faith plays into that. They may seem like two separate topics right now, but I hope that you can see a link between them, that in many ways they can be two sides of the same coin as we look at this today. So I'm going to open us in prayer, and then we'll dig in. Father, we thank you. Thank you for sending your Son. And thank you that you saw the need that we got ourselves into, the mess. And I thank you that you didn't give up on us back in the garden and that you had a greater plan. Thank you for just the wonderful way that has played out throughout the scriptures, throughout the history of our race, and just for the redemptive power of your Son. Thank you we can even be talking to you now and approach your throne so freely. we love you, God, and just pray that you do guide us and direct us as we look at your word today and we study. And because of your son, because of the sacrifice, we can pray, so thank you. In your name we pray. Amen. So this aspect of submission to the Father, and I will say real quick, I apologize for not having a slide presentation this week. If I can do it, it's always great. I know it helps you guys a lot, too. It helps me stay on track as well and not rabbit trail so much. Or at least when I rabbit trail, you know where I started from, so that I have to come back to it. But with Thanksgiving and all this week, I have an excuse. So I'll try to stay on topic here as much as I can. Submitted to the Father in all things. This was a very important, as I said, very important thing for us to see in the life of Christ as he walked and lived and breathed among us. I think it makes all the difference for us to see this and recognize this as being a part of Christ's life, because if you don't look at it from the perspective of him being submitted to the Father and how much he emphasized that, and you just view him, I mean, truly he was and is God. And so as God, God the Son, a member of the Trinity, he has the option of doing whatever he wants, and it's not wrong. He could do that. But if we look at that and simply say, well, Jesus was God, you know, he kind of did his own thing. It puts him on this really unattainable plane. We can't really understand, well, you know, he was God. I don't understand why he did that. I don't understand why he did that. He was God, so I'll never be like that. And it makes it very hard for us to imitate. And if he chose to walk this earth and be that way, that would be one thing, and that would be perfectly fine. But as we just read in Philippians, we read that he did not, even though he was in very form God, he did not count equality with God something to be grasped. He chose to be made as a servant, to be made in the likeness of men, to be made like us, but also our servant. And he came to demonstrate that there was this authority structure in place. There was this for whatever reason, we'll look at it a little bit more, but I'll even warn you now, it's still hard for us to understand this authority structure between two members of the Godhead and why he chose to put himself in submission to the Father. But we cannot ignore that it was a very prominent part of everything that he said. And we are looking to imitate Christ. I mean, the word Christian means little Christ. We're trying to be little Christ. And so I want us to start in Philippians 2 because it is that very concept. Look at Christ. Look at his example. When Paul was writing to the Philippians, he says, you know, if there's any encouragement and love, if there's any of this, if any of this means anything to you, then be of the same mind. And that same mind is really the same mind as Christ. And he looks at Christ as our example, you know, that he was able to come and humble himself. And I wanted to read all the way through verse 16. I'm going to turn back over there too. Simply because I think we usually start around verse or stop around verse 11. But there's this application. It actually starts with application and it ends with application. You know, therefore, because Christ did this, therefore, my beloved, you've always obeyed, so now, not only in my presence, but so much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. And we looked at this verse last week. And what's funny is this week as we were trying to figure out, you know, what I'm going to preach on, things the boys have been working on memorizing Philippians 2, and I think they're up through, I think it's verse 8. And so on Tuesday night they were practicing it for Grammy and Poppy while they're here, and you know, I have to say too, I'm going to embarrass them a bit, but they were afraid I was going to embarrass them for all kinds of reasons. But they did a tremendous job raising their daughters in a Philippians 2 household. From the first time I started, when I first met them, Philippians 2 has always been on their lips of, you know, that. And I really do think each of the girls picked that up, and it was a prominent part of their home. And it really showed of just being demonstrating, following in the examples of Christ. And Philippians 2 is pounded into the girls' head, and I think it really was good that it was. So Leah is following in the same footsteps and pounding in the head of my kids. And it's great, you know, our kids, not my kids, that sounded weird. I wasn't saying something. But it really just is fascinating to see, you know, each of us have this responsibility to follow in the footsteps of Christ. to see him as our example and to become a little Christ in that sense. But there's these application points. Work out your faith. And he goes down all the way through verse 16, and really it continues on to the book, honestly, of looking at how Christ being our example, there should be an outflow of that. The main thing I want us to look, we're going to go back, and I'm just going to cherry pick a few passages throughout Mark as we kind of summarize it, and we go back over there. But we're going to look at the ways in which we see Christ choose to not exert his own authority. Even though he is the Son of Man, he chooses to submit to the Father and make a point of that throughout the book of Mark. And I just want to just bring up the point, and I don't know if I need to say this for anyone in the room today or not, but maybe if it's not for you, maybe it's someone that you're wrestling with sharing Christ with and trying to win them over. The aspect of whether you're on the fence of Jesus, whether he was really who he claimed to be or not. And, you know, I mean, point blank, was he really God, or was he just a charlatan? Was he just another man that was trying to amass followers and get a following and be this, you know, this leader? Or maybe if it's not Jesus, you think maybe the disciples were just trying to get a following to attain power or whatever. And if you're wrestling with that, or you know someone that is, I would ask the question of why would Jesus make this big deal about the authority of the Father? I mean, he had the right and authority, if he is who he claimed to be, to say, I'm God, follow me. I'm the top dog. I'm the king. I'm going to go kill, you know, the Romans. I'm going to take over the world. I'm going to conquer Satan. Follow me. I'm the one that's got it all together. If he was really a charlatan, if he was really just someone trying to create a revolution, as it were, in that sense, I can't really process why he'd bring in this thing of, I don't do anything except for what the Father tells me. I'm in submission to someone as well. I don't know why he would bring that up. Maybe you got a better answer than me, but I haven't been able to think of it. He didn't make this dramatic authoritarian, I am in charge thing. Instead, he presented himself simply as a servant of another, servant of the Father. So this aspect of the authority of the Father, we'll look at a couple examples. Like I said, I'm cherry picking just a few. There's lots of examples throughout Mark. I had a hard time, honestly, staying in Mark because I kept thinking of all these examples, and you probably will too, of when Christ was talking about, you know, I'm not doing my Father's or my own will, I'm doing the Father's. But I had to stay in Mark, so we'll pick some out of there. But in chapter 10, if you go to chapter 10, verses 35 through 40, again, we're not reading all these in detail because we've looked at them this year, but just summarizing what was going on here. In chapter 10, 35, we see James and John, sons of Zebedee. Other books tell us their mother put them up to this. But they come to Christ, and they think they got a free pass to ask anything. They're catching on the fact, I think this guy is God, or he's pretty tight with the Father at least, and so we can get anything we want. And so they ask to seat at his right and left hand. And what's fascinating is Jesus' answer. It's not mine to grant. Now, again, if Jesus was just trying to lead his own revolution, he might say, you know what, why don't you prove yourself? Or, you know, I'll think about it. There might be some kind of answer other than that where the decision rests with him. But he simply says, you know what, guys, that's not my call. In fact, the position's already been filled, it seems, as we look at that. That's not my call. It's the Father's call. And he right there, again, he submits to the fact that I'm not the one that is in charge. There's someone else. Turn over to chapter 13. You see Christ talking in verse 32. He's talking about his return. He's actually all been talking about future events all along. But when he comes to his own return to the earth, he says, concerning that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. This is hard for us to understand. It's hard enough for us to understand the Trinity. But this is, I think, an argument verse that sometimes Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons may use. They don't believe in the Trinity. You can't wrap your mind around how can you be three members of the Godhead yet one member knows something that the other member doesn't. I don't know. I can't even answer the first question of how the Trinity works. But it really comes down to the simple answer that if that's how they've chosen to work, and those three persons have chosen at one point for whatever reason that they're going to have this authority structure, and one of them is choosing to intentionally limit his knowledge from what the Father knows, so be it. That's just what it says. And it doesn't, we don't have to have an answer. You can't take a human construct of, you know, we are a being with a single soul and a single person, and we try to apply that to God and try to make sense of it. We can't do that. For whatever reason, this is how God set it up. And Christ was making a big deal about this when he was on earth. It's not my will, it's the Father's. If you go over to chapter 10, another example here, 10 verses 17 through 30, or 31 really, we have the story of the rich young ruler. He comes, and here we're dealing with salvation, and a man that comes and he's trying to present himself to God as, you know, I've earned it and stuff, and Christ basically shows him, you really, your heart needs to be changed and things like that. And so the man's walking away, and the disciples, because that was to them what was the ideal Christian guy. He was a catch. I mean, he was, you know, he's following the law and the commandments, and he's got money. I mean, let's get that guy. And he's walking away now, and they go, who can be saved at all then if not that guy? And Jesus here says, with man it's impossible, but not with God. For all things are possible. All things are possible with God. He points it back again. I mean, if he was just trying to take credit for himself, you would imagine him saying something like, hey, don't worry, I'm going to the cross, I'm going to save that guy. You know, or I got a plan to redeem him. He'd make it about himself, but he doesn't. He points it to God, to the Father, to one that is over all. And of course, turn to chapter 14. It's the most common one. We could probably preach this entire section just out of this. Where in the garden he's praying and he's in Gethsemane and wrestling, and he is on his knees there, and he says in verse 36 of chapter 14, he says, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will. He knew what was coming, and that part hadn't been limited in his humanity. He still knew what needed to happen. It had also been prophesied. He knew what was coming. And it wasn't just the physical pain and suffering that he was agonizing over there. It was separation from the triune Godhead. We talked about that a couple weeks ago, just how that was literally the most horrific point in human history. There's nothing that can compare to the pain of that. Forget for a moment, I don't want to trivialize the scars, the beatings, the bruisings, and all that, because it was horrific. But you can watch The Passion if you want to see how bad that was. Think about just this aspect of this eternal union being broken, where this perfect being is made sin, made to be sin for us. And in my mind, I picture the most horrific scream that just gives you chills to your bone. And that's what was going on, of this separation between the Father and the Son. And he knew this was coming. Knowing that was coming, even still, he submitted to the Father. I thought about just still carrying on this concept of if Jesus was just a charlatan, if he was just trying to amass followers, or the disciples were trying to create something after he went when they wrote the Gospels, then why do we see this? This agony, this moment that looks really like we see the weakness of his human flesh and yet the strength of his spirit that overcame. I mean, if you really wanted to make a conquering king, you wouldn't show him in this moment of just, Father, please take this cup from me. This agonizing moment. What's fascinating to me, too, is we read other times about where Christ had prayer times. It says he went away to a desolate place to pray. And we don't know what he prayed with the Father, yet for some reason, God saw fit that we are privy to this prayer meeting, that we get an insight into it. And I think, again, the reason is because God wanted us to see the example of his Son. Christ was demonstrating something to us. As painful as things as we have gone through, just like we said, we can't imagine the pain that Christ went through. There's nothing that can compare with it. And he had, I mean, he's God. He had opportunity to escape it, really, right? I mean, he could have, and yet he chose to submit the Father's will. And the reason is because we're told, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. He put his faith, really, in God. And maybe it's hard for you to wrap your mind around the fact that Christ had to have faith. I'm not really sure if that's the right way of saying it or not. I think in his example as a human to us, it's okay for us to say that. He, for the joy set before him, he believed the Father. There was something greater on the other side, that this was worth it. And so he submitted to the Father's will. And this leads to the next section, because now we have Christ as our example. But when we talk about how we're going to live it out, that brings us to this aspect of faith. And what is true biblical faith? It may seem like two separate things, but I hope we can tie them together here. So as we look at faith and we turn there, I got thinking a lot about, you know, what is faith today in our world? It's kind of a buzzword, really. It's in popular media. You got anything from actors to politicians to, you know, other religions and leaders. And you even have atheists that have their own definition for what faith, that word, means. And we're in a Western civilization. We're not even over in the Middle East where this all began. So we're removed 2,000 years later. There's a lot of things that can get built up. And depending on our own interpretation of that word or anything, we can bring our own upbringing, our background, our influences, and we can backwards interpret words. We have to be careful of doing this. And just a quick caution, word of caution there. I think we do this a lot, actually. And you guys know this. We all have to learn what's called a good hermeneutic. That means a good way of studying the Bible. You have to approach it not just kind of willy-nilly. You need to do it consistently in a way that you make sure you're not just pulling out whatever meaning you want to see or whatever makes sense in our modern context. It's one of the reasons that, you know, I would caution against using a dictionary, for instance, to define hard-to-read words in the Bible. Because what you're doing is you're taking a modern tool that defines words, and you're defining a word that was already translated from the original word. And so it's really being double translated in a sense. Might come out the same, but it might not. And a good hermeneutic, a good study, tries to remove our modern influences of a word and look at the original context. So we're trying to look at that today as far as what is biblical faith? What does it really mean to have faith? There's some competing views out there. There's, of course, the generic sense of, you know, like, I have faith my favorite sports team is not going to let me down. I have faith my boss is going to give me my bonus or whatever. We're not talking about that as much. I want to look at the religious uses. There's three kinds that that I think we can at least see. One of them I call the pie-in-the-sky faith. It's kind of this faith being more or less a proper noun, something that's this, oh, he's a man of faith. Or he is in the faith. And it doesn't even always mean anything religious necessarily. Sometimes it does. But it's this very, like, hard to define. If you define it, you're ruining it. Kind of non-religion specific. People use it regardless of what faith you're in. It's this very high level view. The second one is pixie dust faith. And that's what I like to call it. And this, I think, is probably the most common, and it's probably the most dangerous. They're all dangerous. And it's where faith is treated more like a commodity that you acquire. And I think I touched on this a little bit last week. This whole aspect, you know, if you have enough, then God will act. God, some even say, God must act. You know, if you have enough faith, God must do what you you know, God basically must obey you. And to be fair, I mean, that's a very straw man way of saying that, you know, where it's easy to blow down. I suppose if you're in that camp, you'd probably say, well, that's just how God's chosen to limit himself, in the same way we talked about God choosing to limit himself. I want to be fair to that. But I still think it's very dangerous. It's not a biblical faith. It's a very, very dangerous, and we're going to talk about more, because it's where the object of faith is usually pretty subjective. You have something you're attaining for. Like, I really believe such and such will happen. And your faith gets placed in an outcome or something that you really think needs to happen in this situation. And it's more about having faith in something, something else rather than in someone. And we're going to look at that a little bit more. The third one I just call Hollywood faith, and I almost didn't want to bring it up, but we live in a very media-saturated society. We watch a lot of TV, we watch a lot of movies, or we listen to radio or podcasts, or if you don't, then a lot of people around you do. And they define a lot of how we look at things. And I think if you guys, I mean, in most movies or things, the kind of faith that we see, it's usually treated as something that's like this noble, he has faith. You know, but it's always very patronizing of something that, doesn't really make any sense for the moment. Like, he has faith, he'll defuse that bomb. Oh, what? And in the end, somehow it always works out or something. But again, there's no definitive meaning to it. It's this very lofty kind of pixie dustish thing that doesn't really even work in the logical world. Now, I think each of these kinds of faith, they come from original faith in the Bible, but really they're perversions of it. And the reason being is because they twist things into something that benefits man. They come to the point where ultimately when you have faith in an object, faith in an outcome, I think this should happen. And it might even be a really good thing. You know, I really have faith so-and-so should get healed. Or I have faith that, this should all work out, that this well should be drilled for these people, or whatever it is. When you do that, you end up putting that object on the throne. And God gets deceived or dethroned. He gets pulled off. Really, actually, your common sense gets put on the throne. That's how Oswald Chambers put it. But you put your own common sense on the throne. You decide this is the only outcome that should be, and if it doesn't happen, I'm not sure if I have faith in God anymore. We have to be careful because these things, even if you guys are saying, well, I'm not in any of those camps, you probably aren't, and that's fine. But they can taint us. When we live in a society that believes this way, those things can start creeping into the way that we read the text. It does for me. I look back at these things, I have to think, well, wait, what was this really talking about in the first place? What was biblical faith as it was defined in the scriptures here? Like, if we really want to say Christ had faith, then what did even that mean? Now, all throughout the scriptures, we see Christ, and we see other people. I mean, Hebrews 11, we'll go there in a little bit, but we see them demonstrating a different kind of faith. And all throughout Mark, even just the Gospel of Mark, though it's in the other Gospels as well, he's encouraging, you need more faith. You need to believe more. You need to trust more. Your faith is so little. Why are you, you have little faith. He's always talking about faith, faith, faith. And we need to think, what is he talking about? When we look at that first theme that we spent some time on, Christ, his time on earth, it was focused on being submitted to the Father and being in subjection to the Father in all things. I think we mix that with this and we see something that is, quite simply, faith is in the character of God himself. Faith puts God, allows God to be on the throne, quite simply. When we come and we try to imitate the life of Christ, and we say, okay, in this one specific thing, in all things, he was subjecting himself to the Father. God, everything I do, you're in charge. I will follow you. That is lived out by saying, and I trust you. I trust that you are there, you're on the throne, and that you can do whatever you want. You are God. Hebrews 11:6. You can turn there if you want. Can't really talk about faith without going to Hebrews 11. Referred to as the Hall of Faith passage. And it goes through all the saints in the Old Testament, many of them at least, that lived a life of faith. But in verse 6 we see this. It says, without faith, it's impossible to please God, for whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and he rewards those that seek him. And there's this two-part thing that I want us to look at. We must believe that God exists, that God is, some translations simply say, and that he rewards those that seek him. The fascinating thing about our wretched hearts that are being redeemed by the grace of God is that if we're really given the choice between door A and door B. And door A is simply believing that God is, that he exists, and that he does what's right. And he's a good God. I'm just going to kind of paraphrase that for now, the rewards those who seek him. He is, and he is good, right? If you're given the choice between that and putting your faith in an outcome, usually we choose door B. I guess I need to switch them for you guys. I'm A, B. A, B. There we go. We typically want to put our faith in an outcome. It's easier. It's more tangible. It's, I'm looking at all the facts. I think this is how it should go. And so therefore, I'm going to say, I'm going to pray for that because I think I know what's best in this situation. I'm going to say, God, I really want this to happen. Please make it happen. And then it doesn't happen. The problem is when that occurs, quite often, you get to this point where, well, hold on, maybe God's not real at all. Because I had faith and God let me down. I was putting my faith, I mean, I'm supposed to have faith, but your faith was in an outcome. True Hebrews 11:6 faith starts with believing that God is. Not putting him basically on trial. That he has to do this thing that I've set up, and if he doesn't, then I'm going to question his very existence. That's not biblical faith. It starts the other way around. True biblical faith starts with first saying, God, I believe you are, that you exist regardless of how anything goes in this life. And however it looks, I believe that you are, and I believe that you reward those that seek you. Meaning that's your first passion, that's your first responsibility, that's what you're driving towards, to seek after God. And that he will fill you. You know, those that hunger and thirst for righteousness will be filled. Ultimately, true biblical faith, I think, comes down to simply letting God be God. And this is, I think, what we see in the life of Christ, as he submitted himself in all things to the Father, as he demonstrated that for us in all things, all the way up to the Garden of Gethsemane and through the cross and everything. We see that he was letting the Father call the shots. He was the one that, even though a cross doesn't really make sense, I'll go to it. I'll do it. And that's okay, because God, you're in charge. It really starts to, when you really think about God being the definition of all that is good, and he defines things, meaning he invented concepts such as love or justice or mercy or grace. You wouldn't know what that was if he didn't choose to create it, to express it to us, to define it for us, to demonstrate it to us. He is the definer of that. And yet, for most of those things, we feel like we got a pretty good corner on the market for them. Typically, you know, we think we got a pretty good handle on what justice is in the world, for instance. We can look and say, well, that's right, that's wrong. I don't think that should happen. I think that should happen. And maybe there's some gray areas, but probably 80% of it, we think we got a pretty good handle on. And so when we think, again, this is the same concept of putting our own common sense on the throne. And when God doesn't act in accordance with that, we think we have the right to judge God. All those things God defines. He's the one that decides what they are. He defines love. I think we, in our arrogance as humans, we take these aspects and these truths of God, we set them out almost as a God in themselves, and then we try to hold God standard to them. And in that sense, this is probably stretching Romans 1 and 2 a bit, but in a sense, we're worshiping the creation instead of the creator. We're taking aspects that God of himself, and now we're saying, now God, I think I understand this thing called justice that you made up, and so I'm going to hold you to the standard. Well, we're dust. We're tainted dust. We have sin natures. And we really think, even though God's demonstrated, we think that we got a corner on that. And God's like, well, I haven't shown you anything yet. I haven't really even defined that for you. And actually, I tried to show you it, and you got a really bad understanding of it. But regardless, we set ourselves up as judge, and we try to measure God according to it. I'm really hard on this point. And I know it's kind of way out there a bit for now, but I'm hard on it because I think we put ourselves in bondage when we do that. That's a never-ending, very depressing, and very scary cycle to go down. It's really actually quite liberating when you come to the point and you just recognize, you know what, God, you're God. And even if you do something that, you know, 10 years ago I would have thought isn't right, you know, it's me that needs to change, not you. We need to still come to God as little children. We need to still come and recognize that He is the definition of everything. And this is what it means to put God on the throne, to be submitted to the Father in all things. Now, I know most of us probably would agree with this until something tragic or just too big happens in our lives or in the life of someone that we know. And I say this with extreme caution and grace that, you know, I haven't been through those things. And there's some people in this room that have. And you've gone through immeasurable pain that I don't understand. At least I can try to empathize with, but I haven't lived. And yet you're still here. That's a testimony to God's grace. There are some that aren't. There's some that went through those things and it was too much. And they walked away. And we pray for them to come back. But if we're honest about it, there's a lot of people that aren't here still. Maybe not this church specifically, maybe just in the church, in the faith in general. These things get really big, but I think we have to plan ahead. We have to set ourselves up to succeed. We have to look at the fact that at any given point in time, are we setting up our own common sense on the throne? And do we have this kind of line tied to God that, God, I'll follow you as long as. I've heard the statement many times in my life. Many of you may have said it too. I don't even know if I might have said it. This the whole aspect of, I couldn't believe in a God who, fill in the blank. Now, obviously, there's some really obvious things like that. You know, I couldn't believe in a God that thinks murder is a good thing. You know, we're not talking about those. I would just be very cautious about using those statements, even in the really obvious ones. And the reason is because you're putting your own concept or your own common sense on the throne, and you have now drawn a line somewhere. And even if it's really obvious God would never cross that line, you still thought it's okay to draw a line. And you said, if God ever were to cross this line, then I'm going to decide He's not real. And that's not Hebrews 11:6 faith. And it may sound very subtle at this point, but I think those are the things, if we're not setting ourselves up to succeed when those huge trials and those events come, of course Satan knows that. He's going to try to push you to that line where you doubt, and he says, see, look, God crossed your line. He can't be real. And he's going to try to get you there. There are a lot of difficult questions with difficult answers, and maybe some of them don't even have the right answers. But we have to always have this true faith that first starts with, God is God. He defines what is right. He is good. He always is good. He defines what is good. We would know nothing of what is good without Him showing it to us. As we mentioned at the beginning, and we're going to close up here, but there is a lot of examples throughout Mark that you can look at. And you can see Christ as being your example. And we've looked at many of those this year. There's those on that list. Again, I would encourage you guys, maybe take that home and maybe add to it, expand on it. See, write down more ways. How is Christ my example? But in that exercise, I hope that this can be kind of a foundation laid underneath it. That in everything that I seek to imitate Christ on, when I seek to model my life around Christ, at the core of every single one, it has to start with the Father is in control. I am in submission to the Father, no matter what. Louis Giglio did a series, I don't know, it might have even been 10 years ago now, and one of the messages was called Hope. And the theme of the message was, the only reason we can go through trials, any kind of pain, any kind of suffering, is by looking back to the cross. Because if Christ could go through that, we can go through anything. If God could carry Him through the cross, then we can go through anything. But Father has to be Father. He has to be God. He has to be sovereign. We have a pretty powerful sin nature. And it is constantly working. We have to let the Spirit control us. We talked about that last week. But I was just thinking about this aspect of the first promise of that serpent thousands of years ago in the garden was, you can be like God, knowing good and evil. And the truth is we want to not just know good and evil, but we want to define it. We want to be on the throne. And our natures are going to keep trying that. And the rest of our life, for as long as we have breath on this earth, our natures will try to find ways to get back on the throne and draw those lines and put ourselves in the place of God and come to places where we say, okay, God, thanks for showing me that. I think I got it now. I'll sit on this corner of the throne. And we got to be careful continually, just like Christ, all the way through his entire life, he was submitted to the Father. That is, I don't know if that's a good enough summary for Mark, but as I look and as we close that up for the year and we look at being Christ-centered and trying to imitate him, I think that's what I'm going to take with me, and I would hope that you guys do too. Let's close in prayer. Father, again, we thank you for your son and the example that he gives. And Lord, so many times we try to put ourselves on the throne and we take, oh God, we're know-it-all little kids, I guess. We're children that, you know, we think we got it. And Father, you are so much greater. And Solomon warned us of coming to you with many words for a reason, I know. Because you are God. You are seated above everything. You invented all, created all that is good. So we submit ourselves to you this morning, Father. And even as we enter into our prayer and our share time today, and we praise you and we ask for prayer requests, God, I pray that our hearts would just be focused on truly submitting those things to you, to let you do what is best, not calling the shots and deciding what we think should happen, God, but really, truly letting you do what is best. And God, you invite us into that. We thank you that we can be part of that. So we're excited about that as we come before you today in prayer. Thank you for this day, Father, and the fellowship we have in your Son. Thank you for saving us. And if there's anyone in here, God, that doesn't know you, let today be the beginning of that new life where you truly come in and begin to work and recreate them from the inside out. In your name we pray. Amen.